people are coming, the kind of final few people that are coming in are arriving. For those of you that maybe haven't met me before, my name's Aaron Rees. I am Associate Professoral Research Fellow here in the International Inequalities Institute. And we're really excited about our presentation today. I'll introduce the speakers in just a moment. We have just a couple of announcements about forthcoming events that might be of interest to some of you in the room today. So on the 25th of January, there is a kind of half-day session around neoliberalism, social oppression, and class relations. This is going to be split into two components, and I think Bev is heavily involved with one of those, if I remember correctly. So the first half is going to be here in the tower, I think in this room actually, yeah. And that will be between 1 and 6. It's going to be a half-day conference with a variety of speakers, and a keynote from Philippe Bourgeois. I think, am I saying that correctly? Yeah. But also Jeffrey Webber. Pardon?
Sorry. I was calling Bourgeois.
I look at it,
it might not be.
Yeah. I don't know. It looks like Bourgeois to me. But anyway. Jeffrey Webber. Shelley Feldman. And Bev Skeggs. And then in the evening, there's another session from 6:30 till 8 in the Old Theatre, which is, and the sessions will be around ground down by growth, tribe, caste, class, and inequality in the 21st century, with Alfred Shah, James Lurcher, Philippe Bourgeois again, and Katie Gardner. So it sounds like a really interesting set of presentations across the two rooms, but the whole day as well. Our next inequality seminar is going to be given by Dr. Sonia Exley from Social Policy at the LSE on the 30th of January, same time as always. This will be on selective schooling and its relationships to private tutoring in South Korea. So somewhat different, but incredibly interesting, I think, as well. And then on the very last day of January, 31st of January, we have a session that's co-hosted with the Department of Gender Studies on crisis politics and the challenge of intersectional solidarity. This is from Professor Akwugu Emajulu from the University of Warwick, and that will also be in the Old Theatre too. So lots of interesting and fascinating things coming up. But today, we're thrilled to have our three speakers speaking on income inequality and welfare systems in the Yugoslav successor states. We have Dr. Will Bartlett, who is in the middle, who is, I think, senior visiting fellow at the moment here at the Centre on Research in Southeast Europe. But we also have Neming Uruk, who is visiting with us from Sarajevo.
Yes.
And then also Gorana Kristic, who's from the University of Belgrade. So I think, I'm not sure how you're going to divide up the time, but I'm going to leave you to sort that out yourselves. We're going to have them speak for about 45, 50 minutes, and then we'll have time for discussion and questions. But if you could join me in welcoming our speakers today.
Okay, thanks very much for that introduction. It's great to be here. This is the first proper presentation of the project, I think. We're at a very early stage, and we're carrying on till June, so hopefully by June we'll have a more tighter, sort of coherent presentation. So excuse us if this is a little bit disjointed. There's four of us all together, as we've been introduced, but also Jelena Jarković-Rakić from Belgrade, who unfortunately can't be here with us today, but she is also a member of the team. We are looking at this issue of income inequality in the former Yugoslav, some of the former Yugoslav countries. And we have basically three research questions. First one is just to try to identify what is the extent of income inequality in the four Yugoslav successor states that we're looking at, and that's starting from the southmost part of the former country, Serbia, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Croatia, and Slovenia, which is in the north, just south of Austria. And how much has this inequality changed over the last three decades? And the reason we're interested in this is because these are four countries which started out from a common economic and social and political system and have, since the breakup of that Yugoslavia in 1991, have moved in differing directions. And the outcomes in terms of inequality have been very different. So it turns out that the inequality in Slovenia is, as measured by indexes such as the Gini coefficient, for the whole of Europe, is the lowest inequality in Europe. Whereas, in contrast, in Serbia, that's moved in a direction in which inequality is the highest in Europe. So it's a very vivid contrast. Croatia is somewhere in the middle, near the EU average. And as far as we can tell, Bosnia and Herzegovina, where the data is not so good, but it looks like it's moved more in the direction that Serbia has gone in. So that's the that's some of the sort of stylized facts that we're looking at and trying to explain why have these countries, which started out in the same place, moved in such different directions. And so we want to know, basically, what are the factors that determine the level of inequality? And since most of the data we have available and most of the what we've been able to identify so far is that most of the income is labour income, wage income, that most of the focus of the empirical part of the research, at least in the first stage, will be looking at the labour market and the inequality of wages. And then we want to go on to look at, understand why those inequalities have emerged, and we're going to try to look at, in addition to the changes that are taking place in labour markets, so different labour market institutions in different countries, which Nerman is going to talk about towards the end of the presentation. We're also going to be looking at the education systems, the tax and benefit systems as well, as sort of very important factors which might be driving some of these differences. And then, so we want to know, we're going to be looking at how the welfare state has evolved in the four countries and if there's any differences there. So it's the title of the project is Inequality and the Welfare State. So it's these two factors. In order to understand current position today and how the evolution has taken place, we're going to start off by looking at what the inequality and the welfare system looked like in the former Yugoslavia, which is a form of socialism which has sometimes been called market socialism. It was a country which was outside the Iron Curtain. It was somehow in between the East and the West in the period of the Cold War. Yugoslavia was a founder member of the non-aligned movement, which took in a lot of developing countries, India, African countries, other developing countries, as a bloc active in the United Nations, for example, trying to present a intermediate position or a third way between the Soviet bloc and the Western advanced countries. And in this form of socialism in Yugoslavia, it was known as self-management socialism, which was based upon the principles of workplace democracy, workers' councils, electing managers, a high degree of decentralisation. Central planning was abolished in the 1950s. A sort of regulated or quasi-market was introduced with autonomy for enterprise managers to operate, to hire and fire, to sell products on the market, to import and export and so on. It was not like the system in the Soviet bloc where you had central planning, everything directed from the centre. However, it was a one-party state and there was a high degree of political involvement in and some would say interference in the decisions of the managers of enterprises. Along with this decentralized economy, there was also a welfare state which had been inherited from the pre-war period. It was based upon a mixed system of principles of contribution and solidarity. Another way of putting that is combining Bismarckian and universal systems principles of welfare. Some major benefits were provided on a contributory basis: pensions, healthcare, and employment and maternity benefits. Other benefits were on a non-contributory basis: social assistance, child allowance, and war veterans benefits. All of which led to by international comparisons, rather low level of inequality. And in 1968, for example, we have data showing Gini coefficient of 0.24, which is at the sort of low end of the Gini coefficients that you come across in international comparisons. So it was a system which was of some interest because it generated low levels of inequality. It had very high growth rates in the post-war period. Economic growth was rapid in the 1950s and 60s up to the mid-70s and the oil crisis in the 70s. And thereafter, it began to suffer from economic slowdown and stagnation, leading to a worsening position in terms of living standards in the 1980s, and eventually the breakdown of the country at the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 1990s. I mean, there are possibly some parallels with some of the arguments that were put forward at the time. The debates that were going on were rather somehow similar. So I sort of recognise them in the Brexit debate. You know, the Slovenia being the wealthiest republic of this federation, which was based upon a dinar zone, a bit like the eurozone, was, you know, take back control of our money. We don't want to subsidise the southern poorer republics anymore. Take back control of our trade and borders and this sort of thing. And eventually Slovenia was the first country to leave, and then the other countries left afterwards, subsequently. So the successor states emerged from a common institutional background, and there was some degree of path dependency in the sense that the historical legacy was important in explaining what went on, but clearly not a dominant explanation, because if it had been dominant explanation, the countries would all have moved in the same direction, which didn't happen. Of course, there was impacts of wars. The breakup was violent. There were wars, in particularly seriously, in Bosnia and Herzegovina, but also in Croatia, and a short 10-day conflict in Slovenia. And so that obviously had an impact on the economic aspects, the destruction resulting from those wars and displacement and so on. There were also differences in one of the dominant paradigms at the time was the collapse of the socialist systems throughout Europe and the transition from planned economies to market economies. And in Yugoslavia, there was a similar transition from the self-management socialism to capitalism of different types. And this was achieved through privatization of the self-managed enterprises. And one notable difference that could be explanation for the eventual differences in outcomes is the difference in the speed of privatization. Early reformers such as Croatia and also Macedonia, a country which we're not actually considering in the project, but is also there's some data on that, so we're looking at that as well. Much later, in the late 1990s, early 2000s, Bosnia and Serbia began to privatise their economies. Slovenia was a country where privatisation went very gradually, an example of gradual privatisation. And this may be one important factor, the gradual, well, has been put forward as a, an important factor of the changes that took place in Slovenia, is the gradual nature of privatisation in Slovenia. In terms of the welfare systems, the welfare systems also changed in different ways in different countries, primarily due to the influence of outside factors, and particularly the influence of the World Bank and the IMF in Bosnia, Herzegovina and Serbia. The stronger influence of the EU in the EU model of social solidarity in Slovenia and Macedonia, in contrast to this more neoliberal approach proposed by the World Bank and the IMF in Bosnia and Serbia. And Croatia had a sort of more mixed influence of these outside institutions which were transferring policy advice and policy practice throughout the 1990s and the 2000s. And you can trace the way in which, for example, pension systems were, private pension systems were introduced in Croatia, and various changes took place in the welfare systems, which were rather different in the different countries. And then finally, we want to ask, in what way can we connect with the debate upon the varieties of capitalism in the Western world? And is this model that's being proposed, which is focusing very much upon labour market institutions and the bargaining relationships between labour and capital and government, in what way did the differences in those bargaining systems affect the eventual outcomes? So that's another angle which we intend to explore. And, for example, Slovenia has been presented in this literature as a paradigm of what is known as a coordinated market economy, in which capital and labour are very engaged in bargaining over the distribution of income and the setting of wages. And in the literature, that's been compared with Estonia, which is taken as the paradigm of the other type of model of capitalism, which is presented in this literature, the so-called liberal market economy, where you don't have this bargaining, you just have reliance on a more or less free labour market, and you have labour market reforms, and you try to reduce the so-called rigidity of the labour market. You introduce flexible labour markets, and you let the market sort of take prime position. So this contrast between Slovenia and Estonia has been quite well covered. And so the question arises, therefore, can we apply this model to the four countries we're looking at? And if we could, it would presumably be that the Slovenia would be the paradigm for the coordination market economy. And Serbia, with its higher level of inequality, would therefore, by analogy, be a sort of paradigm for liberal market economy. But actually, if we look at what's happened in Serbia, you see, it's very, very far away from liberal market economy. It's not at all liberal, and the market is highly regulated by the government. And the sort of model which we think would be perhaps more appropriate is one of political capitalism, whereby you have a very strong relationship between the political and business elites, which marginalise the trade unions and the workers' interests, and you have a strong interconnection between these elites, which is more or less predatory on the incomes of the lower class people. And we'll see that when we look in more detail at the data. So the next part of the presentation will be given by Gorana, where we're looking in detail at the available survey data, in particular the SILC surveys, which are income surveys, household income surveys, which are implemented in all EU countries and have begun to be implemented in some of the Balkan countries. And we've got data for three of our countries, which Corinne is going to talk about next.
Thank you, Bill. I will first briefly present methodology and data that we use for this project. And then I will present results for Serbia, because as an example, because we have just received the latest SILC data for all our countries. In order to examine the main drivers of income inequality in these countries, we look at different sources of income and their contribution to overall inequality. We will decompose overall income inequality according to different data sources of income, and we will use two methods. First is a factor source decomposition approach, which estimates the contribution of each income source to overall income inequality, and the other is sequential approach, in which each income source is added one after another, and inequality is measured after the inclusion of each income source. The second part of the analysis focuses on wage inequality, because in most countries, wages contributed the most to overall inequality, and we will decompose wage inequality by various characteristics that we think influence wages, such as employment type, sector of industry, gender, age, and other explanatory variables. Two methods will be used. A non-regression-based approach, which actually allow us to decompose wage inequality into two components, between group and within group wage inequality for groups comprised of different characteristics such as type of employment, educational qualifications, and other factors. In the other approach, regression-based approach, we actually quantify and isolate each of these factors in regression type decomposition. Regarding data, we use the latest household survey data. For Serbia, Slovenia, and Croatia, we use a survey of income and living conditions carried out in 2016. And the sample covered individuals older than 15 years of age. The survey collects detailed information on all income sources, on household or on individual level, depending on the source of income. And therefore, it is the best source of data which can be used for such an analysis. And it is based on the Eurostat methodology. So it is harmonized at the EU level, and we will be able to use the same set of variables for all three countries. For Bosnia, the situation is different because this SILC survey hasn't been conducted yet, and we will use household budget survey for 2015. So the analysis that I will present for Serbia relates to a SILC carried out in 2013. Our initial variable is disposable household income, which is monetary income received by households, which can be used for consumption and savings after the payment of social contributions and taxes. It is then adjusted by OECD equivalent scales in order to account for differences in the composition of households and differences in economy of scale. And finally, we obtain equivalized disposable income for which we measure inequality. So as Will mentioned, Serbia has the highest income inequality among the EU countries. And one reason for that is a high percentage of persons who have a very low work intensity. The share of these persons up to 60 years of age is 21% in Serbia, while it is only 10% in the EU. This is an average value for EU.
So how is that defined?
It is percentage, so how persons who live in households with very low work intensity are those who work less than 5.5 months per year. So it's very low work intensity. The main reason for that is a very high inactivity rate of the working age population in Serbia, and also the fact that a low percentage of these persons live with others who work. So in this graph we present income inequality according to work intensity of household members. On a horizontal axis we plot individuals, percent of individuals who live in households with the different levels of work intensity from very low to very high, and on vertical axis we have Gini and half squared coefficient of variation. So we see that income inequality decreases with increase of work intensity of household members, and we also see that the highest drop in inequality is moving from very low to low work intensity. Which is,
So just this is within the Gini, within the income.
No, this is just this is overall Gini.
Decomposed.
No. Decomposition will be done only with other measure of inequality.
So half of.
Sorry.
What are the data points then? Is it countries?
No, for Serbia. This is for Serbia only.
So who's the inequality between? When you say very low, it's 48. Who's that inequality between? What's the population?
The very low this is the work intensity. The inequality is
on within the group of very low, there's an inequality of 0.4 or something.
So it's within low intensity work households, is that right?
Yes.
So you divide up the overall population into households with different work intensities and looking at the inequality within each group.
Well, actually, this is inequality. It is not the composition of inequality according to different groups. It is just plotting the overall Gini according to different...
But it's a within-group Gini, where the groups are defined by the work intensity of the household.
Yes,
right?
Yes. So when we decompose overall inequality using the other measure of inequality, we... see that the largest share of the overall inequality is due to inequality within households with different levels of work intensity. So 81% of the overall inequality is explained by inequality within households with different levels of work intensity. So it means that if we want to reduce inequality, the largest... part of it would be due to inequalities within these households. So, for example, if we employ individuals who are working in these households with very low work intensity, then the most of the inequality will be reduced in that way. The second part of the analysis is based on decomposition by various income sources. We are mostly interested in contribution of each income source to overall inequality. And it is measured as a product of three components. First is a share of each income source in overall income, then Gini coefficient of each income source, and Gini correlation between each income source and overall income. So we see that wages are the most important source of income, and wages contributed 75% to overall income in Serbia. They are unequally distributed because their Gini coefficient is high, and they're unequally distributed predominantly towards better off individuals because their Gini correlation is high. As a result, wages contributed 93% to overall inequality. So most of the inequality is due to wage inequality. The second source is income from self-employment, which accounts for 19% of overall income. It is even more unequally distributed than wages, and this income source is mostly distributed towards the poor households because of low Gini correlation coefficient. Income from self-employment contributed 16% to overall income, and this income source decreased inequality. The last column of this table shows actually the effect of 1% change in each income source on overall inequality. So from that column we can see that wages and income from capital are two sources which actually increase inequality, while all other income sources decreased inequality. The largest impact the largest effect is for taxes and social transfers and pensions. So the second approach which we also use is a sequential approach. It is not very informative if we want to measure the magnitude of contribution of each income source, because in that method each income source is added one after another, and that reference distribution changes each time when we include new income component, because and therefore we use that approach only to compare the results with the EU countries with the latest ILO report, and of course it is useful if we want to see how we come to a final Gini for disposable income of 38. So our initial distribution is wage distribution with Gini of 62. When income from self-employment is added in that distribution, inequality decreased to 56, and income from capital, after the inclusion of income from capital, Gini almost remained the same. After inclusion of private transfers, we come to Gini of 55. It's a Gini of market income. Then, including pensions and other social transfers, Gini further reduced to 40.6. And finally, after the payment of taxes and social contributions, we have a Gini for disposable income of 38. So what is interesting here is that, as I said, Serbia has the highest Gini of disposable income as compared to the EU countries, but Gini for market income is the same as the EU average. So it means that the most important reason for such a high income inequality in Serbia is actually the low redistributive role of social transfers and taxes.
Just
okay.
A clarificatory question. Each successive component of income is reducing inequality.
Yes.
In this case. Is that correct?
Yes.
Because
it
the Gini coefficient
yes.
is going down.
Yes, yes.
Which suggests that there's a negative correlation between self-employment income and wage income. And then there's a negative correlation again between the next factor of income from capital and other incomes. Isn't that right?
Okay. Yeah.
How does that relate to your previous slide where you said that the Gini correlation is so high?
Well, first of all, it is, well, a lot of yeah, a lot of
anyway,
studies.
I mean, maybe you want to have these questions at the end, but since it's quite a technical.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of studies actually compare the results based on these two methods, and sometimes the results are different. For example, in this case, we have that income from capital, although their impact is its impact is small, but it. We can say it increased overall inequality, but
you're calling the Gini correlation is different. It's not the correlation between two different income sources. Like suppose I was
Gini correlation is correlation between each income source and overall income, so it's different
as a fraction of the total Gini, something like that. I mean, Gini correlation, is it just a correlation coefficient?
No, it's not. It's not.
It's the covariance of
yes.
that income
and a cumulative distribution of overall income. Yes.
Covariance between that income source and overall income.
And overall income, yes.
And then, of course, it is additive.
Yes.
That's why you can actually
yes.
in so-called decompose it or disaggregate it. Is
yes.
the better word here.
Yeah. So from this table, we can compare the magnitude of the contribution of each income source with the EU, with the average for the EU countries. And we can see that the effect of social transfers, excluding pensions, is, let's say, more or less comparable to the EU average. But the difference is larger for taxes, which reduce inequality by 2.7 Gini points in Serbia, which is less than the average for the EU. And this is because of the low progressivity of the Serbian tax system. But the largest difference is in pensions, recorded for pensions, because pensions reduce market income inequality by 11 Gini points in Serbia, which is much less than the average for the EU, which is 17 Gini points. So the one of the reasons is smaller coverage of population by pensions, especially in rural areas and among women in Serbia. The second part of the analysis focuses on wage inequality, and we found that wages contributed the most to overall inequality. And first, we decompose the total wage inequality using Jenkins' methodology into a within group and between group inequality, and the groups are male age, education, marital status, industry, degree of urbanization, and region. And we found that most of the wage inequality is explained by within group inequality. And if we look at the between group inequality, then education is the most important factor. In the regression based approach, we start from the OLS regression estimates. The explanatory variables are the same as for the groups that was presented earlier, and all variables are highly significant, and they explain 29% of the total variation in monthly wages. So, although a significant part of the variation in monthly wages is unexplained, if we look at the explained component, we can see that educational qualifications are the most important factor, and educational qualifications account for 63% of that explained part. The other components, groups, which are important are age, degree of urbanization, and region, gender also. So finally, what can we conclude from this analysis for Serbia? First, that quantity and quality of work are important for reducing income inequality, because we found that increasing in work intensity of the household members will reduce inequality, especially if we actually by employing individuals in the households with different level of work intensity, or also by increasing their hours of work. On the other hand, employment growth will contribute to decrease inequality, because the number of people with no salary will decrease, but it's important that increase is happen in good quality jobs in the formal sector with decent wages, good working conditions, and with payment of social contributions and taxes. Regarding educational policies, although our market Gini is comparable to EU average, it's important also to act before individuals enter the labor market in a way to provide equal access for all individuals to education, for good schools, and other educational policies might be also important here as well. Regarding redistributive policies, first, more progressive personal income system will contribute significantly to reduction of income inequality in Serbia, and also better targeting of social transfers to obtain that these transfers are received by those who are in need, those who are not working in the informal sector, for example. And finally, it would also be important to increase coverage of coverage of the population by pensions in rural areas among women. Thank you.
Okay, I'm just going to come back with a little bit of international comparison, having looked at in detail at the Serbian case, and I'm just going to compare Gini coefficients and the ratio of the top 20%, bottom 20% internationally, just to come back to that idea of how these countries differ from each other in some way. I'll try and be brief. This is the picture from data from Eurostat for all EU countries and the four countries, or actually three of the countries we're looking at, plus Macedonia. Bosnia doesn't have the SILC survey, so we don't have this data for Bosnia. And here you can see that, again, they're very high. Gini coefficient for Serbia, I think this is 2015, actually. It's not 2016 data you're looking at. It's a little bit different. Portugal, actually, comes out top in this comparison, but Serbia's second from the top, and Slovenia's second from the bottom. So this is the original income distribution before social transfers. And then we've got after social transfers, we can compare the distribution across countries so the market distribution, then with social transfers, and then with pensions as the third line, which is each time reducing the inequality because of the redistribution effect of the transfers. And you can see here this rather small, although the social transfers are quite high in importance for Serbia, the pension transfers are relatively lower compared to Slovenia. And this ends up, we end up with the final equivalize disposable income. Here, Serbia comes out as the highest in Europe, and Slovenia towards the bottom. Thinking about this issue of low work intensity that Gorina has identified as a very important aspect of explaining the income inequality, you can see that there is some relationship internationally, and it's not very strong, but there is a clear relationship here. You can see there are four countries substituting Macedonia for Bosnia here, but there is some evidence from the international comparison also of that, the importance of that. So, focusing on three of the countries plus Macedonia in comparison with the EU, you can see here the Gini coefficients, here the market Gini, here the Gini after the social transfers, and here the Gini after the pension distribution to pensioners. And you can see there are differences in the impact of the different types of transfers, indicating the differences in welfare effects of welfare systems in the countries. And particularly, you can see the very big improvement in Slovenia. So the welfare system is having a big impact on the Slovenian distribution of income. And this is one of the reasons why Slovenia is much more equal in other countries, whereas in Serbia, the impact of the welfare system, as Gorina was saying, is relatively small. Another way of looking at income inequality is looking at the shares of income attributed or gained by different parts of the income distribution. So we can look at the share of income of the top the top 20% as a relation to the bottom 20%, and we have a similar picture of the distribution here. Here in Serbia, top 20% get 9 times more than the bottom 20%. In Slovenia, it's only 3.6 times. And this is another way of looking at that. This is for the decile income groups, the 10%, bottom 10%, the top 10%. And here you can see for Serbia, the top 10% are getting 27% of the total income. In Slovenia, it's Slovenia is only 20% of the income to the top 10% of the income earners. So this is just another way of looking at the same picture, really. But this, I think, is the interesting slide. Here we've divided the income groups into the bottom 50%, the middle 40%, and the top 10%. And we can sort of, by analogy, think of this as the upper class, the middle class, and the working class. And when you do this, I mean, what is surprising about this particular figure is that the middle group more or less have the same proportion of income, around about 46 to 48% in every country, and the difference in the income distributions. With here we've got Slovenia at the bottom with the bottom 50%, as I say, calling the working class, have 33% of the income. In Serbia, they only have 24% of the income. And what's driving that difference is the very great difference in the incomes of the top 10%. So the explanation of this particular pattern of distribution of incomes is that the middle classes are somehow able to protect their share of income in all countries. And we can the phrase that comes to mind is one that Julian Legrand used to use, the sharp elbows of the middle class, in being able to protect income distribution in different welfare systems. Whereas some countries, such as Serbia and some of the other East European countries, seem to have a very predatory upper class, which is able to appropriate the income from the bottom 50% much more effectively than countries where you have a more solidarity approach, these coordinated market economies such as Slovenia. So that's the conclusion I came to just looking at this data in a very simplistic way. There's no regression analysis here, but it's just looking at that. Okay. So why does inequality differ between countries of former Yugoslavia? Well, we come up with three basic explanations. I've spoken about these in the introduction, so I won't go into them in any detail. But one possibility is the models of the varieties of capitalism and the paths of transition, the bargaining power of capital and labour being different in the different countries. The second explanation is the an approach from political economy looking at the elite composition of the in the different countries and the forms of political capitalism. To what extent is the political elite and the business elite interconnected and intertwined and able to introduce with an outcome of a more predatory type of capitalism than elsewhere? And the third explanation is because most of the income inequality seems to be due to wage labour and the wages, the labour market institutions may be different. This may be a much more just a very different, with a focus on not on the sort of broad political economy, but just a focus on labour markets. So maybe just that the labour market institutions are somehow different. And so that's they're the sort of three directions we're starting to move in. And I'll hand over to Nermin, who's going to talk about the labour market institutions in the three countries.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Just following this third explanation, I'm just going to explain basically this section of analysis related to the investigation of how the different parts of labor market reforms and development of labor market institutions has resulted or can contribute to what you're already seeing as a disparities in inequality measures between the countries. Although sharing some common legacies, we have observed different parts of both, you know, development of inequality, but also some of the possible, you know, underlying factors. So, you know, we can think about these evolutions of labor market institutions as being affected by different experiences of post-conflict development, for example, or different extent or different international organizations involved in different countries. And just came across a table that kind of reminded me, not really surprised, unfortunately, you know, the lead institution of the current reform agenda of Bosnia. The lead institutions for each of the topics are international organizations, and it's really true, you know, since the beginning of transition, you know, we don't really have a clear expression of, you know, strategies and clear specification of development priorities and directions and so on by the government institutions, but it's mainly externally driven. So within this analysis, we'll try to in an exploratory manner, and this since we'll already mentioned, this is an early stage. Today, I'll try just to present a couple of, you know, stylized facts about these in the exploratory analysis about the facts that can explain that these different parts of development of labor market institutions, but throughout the projects we will also include this effect of the EU accession process and the effect of the economic crisis on the labor markets and its role in generating inequality. the key variables in different multivariate analysis of factors, of effect of labor market institutions on inequality in countries, you know, in literature conducted so far, include minimum wages, tax wedge, unemployment benefits, employment protection legislation, collective bargaining, formal employment, other factors that actually are, you know, some of them directly affecting inequality as the, you know, characteristics of the labor market, and some of them indirectly affecting labor, different labor market outcomes. We are not yet at the stage to present a clear, say, the model specification. I guess we'll end up in through the project we'll end up using some multivariate analysis. But at this point, I'm just actually in a setting the stage and as an introduction to what I'll be presenting as initial figures that were collected. Here is a so-called LEMRIG index of labor market, a composite indicator of labor market legislation rigidity using ILO's database of labor market legislation, where they have actually some figures since 1965. These are 5 years periods because legislation is not really, we don't really observe annual changes in legislation. But the most important part is actually the second, you know, the right side of the chart, where we can see this divergence. And most of the other figures that I'm presenting are as I said, exploring divergent trends and outcomes in this evolution of labor market institutions. Employment protection indicators here presented as redundancy rules and redundancy costs, published in IMF's paper by Kovtun and others. Also, as indicated here, show the divergence or different characteristics of these labor market institutions indicator between countries covered in the analysis. Unemployment benefits the same. We can go back to any of these. I'm just trying to save some time and just go through that. I think the minimum wages and tax wedge, I think most of these, all of these charts, you know, without really, you know, going into details, just I think send the key message, which you know we are we would like to show you today, is it is the exploratory analysis shows that there are divergent paths of development of labor market institutions in countries of ex-Yugoslavia, and the next stage is to actually establish, say, maybe not attribution, but contribution of these developments to the changes in income inequality in these countries. Here, I just this is not correlation. I just plotted some of the variables available in paper by Farkas and Gini Index, which is also used in this paper, to show basically that although, for example, we have rather high trade union density in all the countries of the covered, you know, of ex-Yugoslavia, we still have variations in the Gini Index. Then, for example, cooperation labor-employer relations, where it's often said that we would expect much higher scores for these countries, as Will mentioned already, actually coming from or transitioning from the peer, from the self-management system, but unfortunately this transition did not really transform this self-management relations into labor force employers relations. Then we have employment protection legislation, where we have let's say, more variation within these countries. So some of these indicators say are common, but not really reflected in the differences in the gene, at least through this positioning. And we obviously need to conduct serious analysis to see what are the significant factors of these commonly used labor market institution indicators in affecting income inequality. So the key message shortly is we can observe differences in both development through the period, but also the current stage, current status or characteristics, labor market institutions that are also reflected in different characteristics of labor market outcomes in between countries of the Western Balkans. And we will work on analysis of relationship between these or effect of these labor market institutions on inequality, and hopefully, as we refer to this role of international organizations, where the promotion of more flexibility at the labor market was argumented by or supported by arguments of allocative and dynamic efficiency, with rather ignoring this equity part. Hopefully this will also, this evidence will contribute to taking this more in consideration for development of future design of future policies related also to labor market institutions, but the other policies that also Will mentioned, education and so on. That's it for me. For now, hopefully, as Will said, we'll be here in June, and hope to present. As some of you know, due to some problems, I don't need to go into detail of my delayed arrival here, has resulted in maybe less progress than I expected by now. This is my second day at the Institute, and such a great environment, I think, helped me to be sufficiently productive. So if I continue, at this pace, and I'm sure I will, with all of you, we'll have a lot to present next time. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you very much. We have time for some questions and conversation. Yes, please, thank you.
I would like to pick up on the labor markets issue. You mentioned dynamic efficiency and allocation and things. I think the way you presented the wage composition, basically there's a kind of recency bias, so to speak, in all good faith, that you find that, let's say, education accounts a lot for inequality for wages, yeah? And then you say that education creates inequalities. Then one implication of that would be that we have to minimize education, sort of make everybody with zero education. You wouldn't really want to live in a labor market where education doesn't pay. Yeah, education doesn't pay in very, very primitive societies where it doesn't matter if you have education because there's no productivity gain from education. There's other things like gender, marital status, where you would want to eliminate the premium associated with those things. Yeah, like there's no reason why if you got a full education experience and stuff, women should get paid less usually than males or married people and stuff. But so I think, you know, one element of that, of the analysis, is to actually look at the kind of good factors that create differentiation and bad factors. And then I think it's more, it's easy to say, more difficult to do. The other thing is how labor market institutions may affect all these things. So as you mentioned, yes, of course, deregulation, flexibility, whatever, reduce minimum wages will, the expectation is increase the sensitivity of wages to education levels, for example. May create also different sorts of inequalities of different types, but it could also affect things that you do not observe in the wage equation, like the non-working households. It may create more, sort of incentivize labor supply, whatever that means, or create more demand, create more employment. So you increase inequalities in the labor market for salaried labor, but actually you increase employment participation and then the others. So I think, like, it's I think it's very difficult to put all these things together. And so do you have an idea of how all these connect, or how do you handle all this? Because so my point is that if you focus on each point at a time, then you never get a holistic picture of what actually happens.
Me? Okay. I agree. We need to, will obviously need to be selective and in-depth analysis of, you know, particular issues. But I think this is what we already discussed yesterday. During the first half of my stay here, we need. I think we agree that what we would like to actually explore is, say, factors not only or not dominantly factors affecting inequality of outcomes, but particularly factors affecting inequalities of opportunity. And then, for example, within this, you know, labor market institutions area, I would say, for example, you know, most of the countries have rather high public sector wage premium, for example, which affects inequalities. And then within this, you know, dual labor market, you know, you have the evidence shows that, you know, we don't really have equal opportunities, and this goes back or is related also to this, what Bill mentioned, political capitalism, state capture zone. So yeah, it is an interconnection of you know, variety of factors, and you know, in order to really the holistic picture is, say, something that can be broadly discussed, but I'm not sure all of these can be really investigated in depth within a single project.
Well, we've got a few questions. Simon, well, I don't know if you're sorry, but yes.
So these are mostly just kind of methodological or background questions rather than kind of challenging what you've done. But it'd be really interesting to see some of your reasoning behind your choices. So the first is, you talk a lot about income inequality, but not much about asset or wealth inequality. And especially because there's this transition where there's a huge wave of privatization, you'd expect that inequality would show up in assets. And it'd also just be interesting to hear about what happened in terms of, like, house ownership and the housing market. And then secondly, I think it was touched upon in the fact that there are a lot of questions about it. But, like, could you explain a bit what this work intensity measure is? And why did you choose it over something more standard, like unemployment or underemployment? Is it that it captures the forms of underemployment that you see in the Western Balkans more effectively, say, than other regions?
So regarding your second question, work intensity of household members is a standard indicator, Eurostat, one of the Eurostat indicators among, I think, 40 or 50 SILC indicators, which is published by the Eurostat every year. And it is important because it measures quantity of employment or intensity of employment. We also have, if we look at the other source of data, which is a labor force survey, we can use hours of work to measure intensity of work. But this measure is available only using SILC data. So, and the benefit of this measure is because you can analyze it in line with other indicators, for example, look at the dependence of the inequality and other labor market indicators, and it is it's not always presented. I mean, for example, within LFS survey reports, you can easily find all indicators, such as the main labor market indicators, such as employment rate, unemployment rate, and so on. But hours of work are not provided in these quarterly reports. And it could be the case that, for example, as it is the case in Serbia, that the main labor market market indicators improved, but it is not the case with the intensity of work, like percentage of population who work in households with very low work intensity. So, for example, when we measure average work intensity of all individuals included in SILC 2015, we realized that intensity of work decreased, while main labor market indicators based on LFS has improved. So it is important just to have the whole picture, not only the to supplement these main labor market indicators with intensity, with other indicators.
If I could just add, I think you're absolutely right when you point to the question of the sort of assets and the income from capital, and the fact that, you know, the one of the main changes which took place in the transition was that from a system where you basically didn't have a capital market and you didn't have capitalists, that was the self-management, was basically abolishing capital owners and, you know, the residual income going to capital owners. And you introduce that, and you introduce capital ownership, and you transformed all the asset positions in the company. So you would expect that, in fact, quite a lot of the story about income inequality is due to differences in capital income compared to labour income. But this actually just doesn't come out in the surveys, because basically I think the household surveys just don't capture that. And it's just sort of a missing, unknown variable, if you like. So that's something we have to look at from a different perspective. And we're going to be looking in detail at the privatisation process in the four countries in the 1990s, early 2000s, trying to, from a more qualitative perspective, trying to understand what was going on, what the differences were. And the other related aspect of that is that the regression analysis that Barina has done and that you would get from these sort of surveys, only, I think it's 29%, isn't it, of the variation in incomes is actually explained by the factors that you're looking at. So there's a huge unexplained variation in incomes, which we've got, you've got no idea from the data what actually is going on there. So again, that calls for some further qualitative research. And I mean, the differences in income that we can explain through this regression analysis, I mean, it comes out, as you're saying, that the education factor is tremendously important. But I mean, of course, that's what you'd expect, and that's what Vasilis was talking about. I mean, this is sort of good inequalities. This is what you want. You want to have some sort of reward for higher skills and this sort of thing. So there is, within the inequality we can explain, that is not necessarily, that 29% is not necessarily a bad thing. but it's the sort of the other 70% where we don't know what's going on that might be the really sort of bad and undesirable type of inequality. And you also mentioned housing. In the ex-Yugoslavia countries, housing was more or less privatised immediately in the early 1990s everywhere, thus more or less abolishing the rental market, because the rental holders of social housing were actually more or less given their flats, and mostly flats, for peanuts. You know, it was a very rapid and fast move towards private ownership of the housing stock. That's a just important issue.
Paul, and
Samir, and then we'll have to have something here as well. Just firstly, on this education question, I think it would be useful to give something like education premiums or kind of returns to years of education so that you can then compare it with other countries. Because, I mean, sure, some degree of inequality between education levels seems warranted and efficient, etc., but clearly there's a limit. And so if you compare, you know, if it's higher than, say, in Germany, then we know it's higher than is necessary to be an extremely successful market economy. Right? So it's useful to do a comparison like that. The point I wanted to make was related to what you were saying about capital incomes that aren't being measured here, and relating that to the different explanations for inequality. So it's very interesting that you find that in Serbia, the most unequal country, the market income is pretty much the same as in other economies. But that would suggest that it presumably isn't about bargaining between capital and labour to keep market inequality equal, or at least your data don't support that. That explanation, except that, as you said, it might be the case that you're missing a whole lot of inequality due to capital income, in which case it could be the labour market story, but you'd have to show that using income that you don't have yet. So I don't know if there's any top income data, any tax data that you've used in any of those countries that could be very useful. But so if you're finding that actually it's about the taxation and social benefit story, then of course that needs a different kind of explanation from
but I just want to add here that missing capital from this data is not only, you know, the problem in Serbian data.
No, it's in all households.
In that case, that market income is comparable, you know, to the EU average, because it is not captured in any EU country. I mean, we can assume that the coverage is almost more or less the same. So in that sense, we can compare and we can assume that market income is more or less comparable.
But that also suggests then that you can't really use, an argument that's based on capital income, like the rise of capitalism type argument, to explain your data. If none of the data include capital income, then you can't explain that data with an argument that uses capital.
Yeah, in addition, even with access to tax data, we are actually missing capital because it's not taxed.
Actually, just following up from what Paul said, it might be very useful if you estimated what are known as earnings functions, a logarithm of income against schooling or years of education, age, because two of the variables that you had identified as being responsible for inequality were education and age, yes? So an earnings function, a la Jacob Mincer, if you like, you know, the earnings functions. So that's a comment. But I also have many questions, but I'll just limit them to two. When you talk about inequality, is it inequality across households or individuals?
The first one.
You've talked about inequality right through.
Yes.
Is it inequality across households or across individuals within households? Not within households, but each individual within a household being assigned the household income per equivalent adult. So which one is it?
It is inequality among individuals.
So
because for each individual, we have disposable in equivalized income.
Household equivalent income, yeah, but per person in the household, whether that person's 5 years old or 50 years old, right?
Therefore,
yeah. So the second question, which actually was your attempt to understand the magnitude of the sources of inequality, you used an approach which sequentially added sources from starting, I think it was with wage income, then you added some self-employment income, etc. Now, of course, you realize that if you change the order, you'll get completely different answers. Mm-hmm. Yet you were comparing that with what's happening in other countries. Mm-hmm. So I don't see... Did the other countries use exactly the same ordering?
Yes. No. Yes.
So you mean they start with wage income, then go on to self-employment income, then go on to capital income, then go on to pensions, etc. It's the same order. But in any case, but the more general point is that the order matters in terms of what you get. So therefore, it's not such a good method of isolating the contribution to overall income inequality from each particular source.
The first method is more... suitable for estimating contribution of each income source. And the other is just, you know, we wanted to see where Serbia stands.
Okay. I think Corina did mention that in her presentation. You know, she's got the regression model and the sequential model. Sequential model being simply a sort of backup to the...
I was just trying to understand whether the sequence is something you had chosen or it's a universal sequence across European Union, and if so, why?
The latest ILO report used that method, so I just wanted to see what would be the results for Serbia.
Thank you. Yes, please.
I think so much. I found it very interesting. I have a technical question on the Serbian presentation and then another question because I don't know the project and it's the first time I've seen it about it. So you said that the decomposition revealed that wages as a source of income contributes the most inequality, which makes sense because it's the highest share of income. And then you said that wages are unequally distributed in the case of Serbia, but you said that the market income inequality of Serbia is actually comparable to the other member states. And I was a bit confused, and I wanted to ask you whether wages are more unequally distributed in Serbia compared to the other Western Balkans.
Well, we haven't done the same analysis for other countries, but we will do exactly the same type of decomposition.
Because my first idea is that, since market income is comparable, it's not that wages are more unequally distributed in Serbia. The reason that they contribute more to inequality is because of the highest income as a source, it's 75%. But, I mean, I don't know, but
the three components contribute to the contribution of each income source to overall inequality, the share of income, you know, Gini and Gini correlation. So Gini correlation is high, probably. That would be
Yes, but that's why I'm asking whether, compared to the other Western Balkans, we see it, I mean, something more extreme with the case of Serbia, because I wasn't sure whether that was...
have that answer.
I will be interested to see. And then my second question is overall, in general, I like the question, so why do we see different inequality trends among Western Balkans? And directly, I thought, why not? In my understanding of it, there are a lot of factors that have happened since the dissolution of Yugoslavia that have influenced a lot of inequality trends. And even during the Yugoslav era, I guess that there were a lot of differences among the different republics. So my question is, why would we expect to see the same? So why would we do that? And if this is the broad question of the project, why do we start from looking inequality levels at 2016? And you don't go back to the earlier data. I mean, the first is the silk waves that you actually have for these countries. And lastly, why don't you do a time? So why do we just observe the levels and we don't also see the trends through time since the moment we have the data?
Thank you.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is, you know, coming from a common basis, why did this big divergence take place? Okay, I mean, you say, well, why shouldn't it take place? But we want to understand the reasons why it took place and the factors behind it. And it's an interesting question. I think it's you know, it gives some sort of insight into the processes driving inequality in Europe, in transition countries, in countries which break up. You know, there are various sort of motivating factors there. I can't remember your other questions, but
the question was a bit more about considering whether it's possible to actually look at the trends within these.
Oh no, we are going to look at trends. We started with the latest data. We have a couple of research assistants coming in who are going to be sort of digging around in the data from the library that is not processed in the international databases. In fact, in the LSE library, there's a fantastic collection of statistical yearbooks and statistical sources going back to the 1960s. You know, it's a really very rich data source that we're going to look at over a period of decades. And also, we're going to do, we have another research assistant that's going to focus on the qualitative research, looking at precisely at the privatisation processes in the 1990s and comparing the impact of different approaches to privatisation, therefore to capital ownership and asset distribution.
Thank you very much. I think we should wrap up there, but if you join me again, thank you, my speakers.